Okay, it is such an honor. Well, before we go any further, how many Westchester people are in the house? Yay! New York City! Staten Island! Queens! I know there's some New Jerseyites here. I believe I covered all the boroughs except the Bronx! Yay! And I am so pleased. Oh, wait. I was wrong. 10-step. Brooklyn! Yay! Okay, let's try this again. The Bronx! Okay, I am so pleased. Live from the Bronx, a real firecracker. Love her energy. She's so positive. I am so pleased to introduce Beverly D from the New Attitudes Group. Yay, Beverly! Yay!
Mama, ma.
I never got an introduction like that. Okay. Hi, family. My name is Beverly, and I'm from the Bronx, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Beverly.
If you want to know the truth, my name is Beverly Louise, and I'm from Atlanta, Georgia, and I'm a drunk. All right. Let me. I've had people say a lot of things about me, and I've had went to a lot of places, and it was a lot of people there when I first got there, but it seemed like it kind of thinned out once I got there for a minute and took two or three drinks. I don't understand what happened, but, you know, it just kind of went that way. I want to thank you so much. I want to thank everybody for this opportunity. I want to thank the steering committee. I want to thank the selection committee. I just want to get, you know, thank you so much for having me as part of your family. Let me say that. When I say, hi, family, my name is Beverly, I really mean that. So thank you. Thank you very much. Now, let me, firecracker, huh? I heard a raising hell, you know. Okay. I'm originally from Atlanta, Georgia. No, you can't tell, but... I'm originally from Atlanta, Georgia, and I'm one of four children. My mother had two girls and two boys, and she gave the two girls away and she kept the two boys. Didn't understand that, but that's how it went. One of the things I want to tell you is that who she gave me to was her best friend. Now, this is a story that this is the way it went. My real family drank, my biological family drank, my mother, my grandmother, my father, my aunts, they drank. The adopted people that got me sold liquor. And that's the way that went. So, now, it's amazing to me when I say this, it's the way some people look. Selling liquor in Georgia was a family business. That's the way it went. And I was a little thing, so when the police came around, because, you know, I was the alarm, they take me and put me out the window, and I run up the alley and tell everybody that the police was coming. Because, you know, in Georgia, when you sold liquor, you hid it in the backyard, you hid it in certain places. So when the police came, you had to get rid of it. It was a product. You know, you had to get rid of it. So I would run up the alley and tell them that the police was coming and all this type of stuff. And one of the things that I saw when you sell liquor is that I've seen my father jump out of windows. I saw him hide under the bed, you know, and I saw my mother have dealings with the police and all this type of thing. Now, when you sell liquor and you drink liquor, two things happen. When you drink it, you learn how to deal with the family business. You know, I was serving alcohol to my family at a young age. I knew how to pour half a pint in a mason's jar, you know, or a little glass. I knew not to spill it. I knew how to do whatever you needed done. And when you sold liquor, you were able to buy a house on the right side of the track, across the street. Okay? One of the things that happened with that was that the house that we bought had let me see if I can take you there. It had about 16 steps in front of it. It had 12, then a little walkway, then 6, right? And I used to sit on the steps, and I would watch my real family stand out there and fight and curse and carry on. And I had a best friend named Jeannie. And we would sit there and cry with each other and say, why are they doing that to me? Why do they want to embarrass me like that? Now, in the neighborhood that I lived in, everybody knew you. See, one thing about Georgia, nobody called you by your name, and if they did, they reached into the middle part of your name, which was Louise for me. See, I was always Rosa Mae's little heifer, Uncle Henry's little gal, Jean's sister, and I just couldn't wait to get grown so I could just be me. So I don't remember exactly when I started drinking. I can't tell you a particular age, but I'm going to tell you this. When I started drinking, the hand went on the hip, and I was grown. You couldn't tell me nothing. I was not Rosa Mae's little girl. I was not Uncle Henry's little heifer, and I wasn't Jean's little sister, you know. And I was grown, but, you know, my mother didn't recognize that, but I was. So anyway, I started drinking, and I was a blackout drinker right away. And what happened was that they had a, my girlfriends and I used to go down to this place called Fort McPherson. And we would go down to the Fort McPherson. And when it started out, it was like, girl, do you know what you did last night? You so crazy. Then they would say, girl, you know what you did last night? Then it got to, girl, you know what you did last night? And of course, I didn't want to know what I did, and I couldn't remember what I did. And if not only that, they were lying anyway, because they were just jealous. So I decided not to go out with them anymore for approximately 3 weeks. And then they called me, because they would call me every Friday night. So then they would call me, and I forgot right away and went back and started all over again. Anyway, I had started drinking. And by the age of 17, I had 2 children. But I gave my son up for adoption when he was young, very young. And my mother kept my daughter. So I decided that when I was drinking, you know, I had started falling up the steps, and I had started saying things and doing things. And my mother asked me a question that I couldn't answer. She said, what's wrong, baby? Why are you drinking so much? And I couldn't answer that question, you know. So I decided, the brilliant thinker that I am, that I saw this ad, and I figured that I wasn't doing so good in Georgia. Now, I've been living in Georgia all my life, but all of a sudden I decided they were prejudiced. So I decided that I would come. I saw this ad that said something about Job Corps. So that was the perfect thing. Okay, I'm going to go to Job Corps. I'm going to make my mother proud, because you know you always want to make people proud. I'm going to make my mother proud. I'm going to do the right thing. And I had to leave Georgia to do this. So it said to go to Jersey. All right. So I went, I got everything together, and my mother agreed, and I went, you know. And I got there, and you know how the feeling come over you? I might have made a mistake here. It's a possibility. So I called home, and I said, Mama, you know, I said, I'm homesick, and I don't think, I think I made the wrong choice. And she said, no, baby, stay, you know. She said, you'll be all right. And so I'm calling home every night, and I'm crying, and it's just not, but I'm doing well in school, I'm this and that and the other. And then one weekend, a young lady came to me and said, you ever been to Brooklyn? I said, no. She said, come go with me. I said, okay. I went to Brooklyn, and she took me to a bar. Well, I was home. They were looking for me for the next 3 weeks to tell me that my mother was calling up there trying to find her child. And listen, my mother got ill, and I had to come home. And when I came home, she got better. My mother owned a nursery. She started a nursery when I was 12, and you had built into a large business. And I came home, and I didn't stay long, you know, and I came back. And I met this young lady in Job Corps that told me that if I ever came back to New York, you know, I could stay with her and her mother and, you know, whatever. So I came back to New York, and I got a job at this place called Dana's Perfume Company. Now, they gave me a job with the title of co-op advertiser. I have no idea what it meant. Don't ask me. All I know is that I was supposed to measure some things, send it to the company, and people paid us. I got a paycheck. That's all I know. They gave me the first 2 paychecks, and I started coming up with all kinds of excuses why I couldn't come to work. My aunt in Philadelphia is coming to New York for the first time. I have to be there with her, and she's looking for me to take her around New York. My mother is definitely ill. I think I'm going to have to go home. I think I must have worked 3 weeks and look for a paycheck. I went and picked up that last paycheck, and I didn't go anymore. Then I got a job. Somebody told me to go sign up for the post office. That was a great idea. I went and got the job, and, you know, it wasn't like it is now that you have to wait forever. I signed up, I think, in April, and before August, I was working at the post office, and I was doing well, very well, till somebody said, do you want to go to the bar across the street? And see, when I got, it's an education in the post office. See, when I got to the bar, then they told me how you can clock in, come to the bar, go back, clock out, and get paid. I'd never heard of anything like this. This is a wonderful country. I never heard of anything like this. Right? So, but see, the problem with drinking alcohol is that you clock in, start drinking, and you don't feel like going back. At least I didn't, you know. I forgot all about clocking out. I really did, you know, and wonder what happened when the money didn't come right. You know, anyway, I came back up, and that was going on, and my mother passed. And I had to go home. Now, in the meantime, my daughter was with my mother. So when my mother passed, remember, I have a child, you know. And so when I went home, this little four-year-old girl come running to me with her hands up hollering, Mommy, Mommy. I started to look around to see who she was talking to, but you know. And to be honest with you, and I have to say this, I was angry. I was so angry at my mother because how dare she die. You know, I really was. I had no idea what to do with a child, had no intentions of knowing what to do with a child, you know. So Mommy died, and here I am with this child, right? And Daddy was so glad to see his child come home, because remember, they had a business. His daughter was coming home to save the business. The man reached up in the cabinet and pulled down a half a pint and put it on the table, two shot glasses. He was explaining the business to me as he was pouring. I don't know what he said, because I was watching that liquor. He picked up the glass, took a shot, put the bottle back up in the cabinet. I didn't understand what he was doing. Why is he moving it, you know? Let me tell you, I had no idea I was an alcoholic, but I couldn't stay there. I couldn't stay there. Unfortunately, I couldn't help my father with that, with the business or whatever. And my daughter had to end up going to stay with my aunt in Philadelphia for a couple of years. But anyway, I ended up back in New York. Now, I'm going to kind of cut this kind of short because I don't have a lot of time to tell you all this. But let me tell you something. I came back to New York. I met a man that I thought was the finest thing that God ever made. He thought I was the finest thing that God ever made. His birthday was December the 11th. My birthday is December the 13th. Our anniversary was December the 12th, and we own December. That was it. That was it. We claimed December, and we went together and had 15 years of the most insanity you ever want to see, okay? That was us. I was the type of person that, you know, I always wanted to be the best of everything. So I was going to be the best hostess and all of this thing. When it started out, because it started out, if you came to my house, I loved decanters. I had a decanter for you if you drank vodka. I had a decanter for you if you drank rum. I had, you know, all this fancy stuff. I had this kind of stuff, you know. And it started out with you come there, but I was one thing about me. If I was hungry and I took a drink, my appetite left. But you come to my house, and I was going to serve you, and I would cook and serve you and all that kind of stuff. That's how it started out. Because let me tell you something about me. I was one of those never people. I was never going to drink out the bottle, never going to drink on the corner with men, you know, never going to drink wine, never going to do all that kind of stuff. One of them never people. Turned around, honey, got to the point that I would sit the bottle in the middle of the table, and if it got down too low and whatever was left, if you didn't have no money, you wasn't getting none. That was as simple as that. And then we found out that I was one of those people also that if I thought something was wrong with me, because I didn't know I was an alcoholic, and I thought something was wrong with me, I would do one of two things. I would get a part-time job, because I wasn't going to work full-time, because they were going to mess with my welfare, and I ain't going to deal with that. And I would either go to school. Wasn't going to finish none, but I would go to school. And I was doing one of these things because I had these friends that used to sit on the stoop all the time, right? And I would say to my daughter, I would pass them. And I'd be coming home. I was either going to school or work, one of them that I wasn't going to finish. And I would pass them, and I would go to my house. And when I get upstairs, I would kick off my shoes and pour a drink and go to the window. And I would call my daughter. And I would tell her, look at that. That's a thing. That's all they do all day long is sit on that stoop and drink. If I got that bad, I'd leave it alone. She said, yeah, Ma. Yeah. So, you know, if I had $2 over lunch money, I was the boss. So I remember I was passing them one day, and they said, come on, Beverly, and have a drink. I said, oh, no. And I went to the house, and they said, come on, Beverly, and have a drink. I said, oh, no. But somewhere along the way, I started walking with a cup in my pocketbook. I don't know when that happened. And then this particular day, they said, come on, Beverly, and have a drink. And I said, just one. And I sat on that stoop for years, okay? Anyway, I remember I was, when I discovered that things were really going wrong, and I want to say this part, and I'm going to tell you how I got here and tell you what's been going on me since I've been here. Because a lot of alcohol just erased so many things, you know. When I came to AA, I was unemployable. But before I get to that part, I remember sitting at the table one day and saying to myself, my life is not the way I thought it should be. And, you know, the thing that got me was always it was somebody else. You know, when you hear somebody else say it, you just don't hear it. But it was always somebody else or something else's fault. If my old man would have stayed off that corner with them people that didn't want to do nothing, they had no motivation. You know, and if he'd have just messed around with people that wanted something out of life, you know, or if he just listened to me, we'd get further in life. This is what I told myself. And then I was one of those people that I had this club. I had a red carpet trimmed in blue. I would put on the light. I wore wigs and eyelashes. I turn on my slow music, and I sit there and sing to myself. And that was the way things were going for me. And then I remember one day my daughter was talking to me about drinking too much, and I told her, I said, you know, I'm not going to drink until you come home from school. That was the worst lie I could have ever told. That girl, I couldn't wait for her to get home from school. She put the key in the door and started turning, and I started pouring, you know. She said, I thought you weren't going to drink, because you don't tell me what to do. I'm your mother. You're not mine, you know. And that's the way things went. And I was sitting down one day, and I was looking at the drink, and I picked it up, and I said, it couldn't be this. And I took a drink, and it confirmed it wasn't that, you know. I have to tell you that I went through a lot of things when I was drinking. Alcohol made me very fearful of the world. My world had gotten so small, and this is what it did before me before I came in. My world had gotten so small that I was losing time, and my Bowery was my bedroom before I came in here. But let me tell you about this losing time. It was a lady that lived on my block. And I would look out the window, and I would see her. And every time I saw this woman, she had on a different outfit, but it looked like I'm just looking at her. So you know how sometimes people go to different places, and they take they a whole lot of wardrobe, and they want to change clothes so they can show people what they got? I said, what is she doing? I said, she got so many clothes, she want to just keep changing and carrying on. She changes clothes every 15 minutes. I got sober and found out that the woman was going to work. I was missing days. Yeah. I had gotten to the point where I was looking at the TV to see what time it was because I didn't want to see the look in my daughter's eyes anymore. You know, when I say, well, what time is it? You know, one of those type of things. And anyway, it was when I told you I was going to never drink out the bottle and never going to drink with men. Well, you know, that didn't last too long. I went to the corner. I was waiting on my significant other, and I went to the corner. He was standing with the guys drinking, and of course, you know, I wanted some of it, and when I started drinking it, I found out you can get just as drunk on wine as you can on vodka, and it costs less money. Made sense to me, you know, one of those type of things. Then, I have to tell you this. I got so sick that I had seizure. And I had a seizure, and the reason I had the seizure, well, the reason I had the seizure because I was drinking, however. The seizure came about when I had told my daughter I wanted to babysit. My daughter had a daughter, and I wanted to babysit with my grandchild. And my daughter wouldn't let me babysit. You know, I got an attitude behind that. You know, she wouldn't let me babysit with my grandchild. Now, I'm drunk as everything, but I didn't think that was right. It didn't matter that I was bumping into walls and saying, excuse me. That didn't count. You know, they had nothing to do with it, you know. And I don't know what happened this weekend. I still can't recall why she let me babysit, but she let me babysit with my granddaughter. And my granddaughter was in a walker. And I remember going to the bathroom, and then I remember pulling up the jeans, and the next thing I know, they were standing over me saying, are you all right? You know, the medics and all that stuff. And I said they were going to take me to the doctor, but I said, I'll go to my doctor, you know. So I went to the doctor, and the doctor said to me, do you know what happened? I said, no, you're the doctor. Do you know what happened? So he said to me, you had alcohol withdrawal, and it can kill you. Now, you see, I've done a lot of things in my life, and I've withdrawn from a lot of things, and it didn't kill me, so he didn't know what he was talking about as far as I was concerned. So he said, I tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to give you these pills. If you go home, take the pills, take the pills, don't drink. If you drink, don't stop because you'll go into a seizure. All right. I went home, I took the pills for a couple of days. I woke up one morning, my significant other was asleep. I took a drink, he woke up and said, did you take your medication? I said, well, I can't take no pills because I've been drinking and I can't stop drinking. I said, because I'll go into a seizure. So I drank myself into another seizure. Anyway, I got to kind of wind this down. Okay. What happened was one morning I woke up and we had drank a bottle of vodka and my favorite chaser was Colt 45. Yeah, I know. Anyway, this particular day we had money, you know, we had money. And we had drank a bottle of vodka, and I went in the refrigerator, and I was drinking a Colt 45. And at that time, I looked at my wall, which was white, and I just saw me going nowhere, and I had such a despair. I had such a feeling in me that I had never had before. And I had met a lady earlier in life, wherever, and had given me a number. And, you know, when I got drunk, my house got drunk, so I tried to find this number. But I found the number, and I remember saying, God, I can't do this anymore. And anyway, the number was to Intergroup, and Intergroup led me to an outpatient program, and I went to that outpatient program. Now, I'm going to have to skip over a lot of that, but this is what happened with me. When I went to that outpatient program, they told me I was going to be there 6 months, and they said that I had to go to this place called AA. So I found out about AA, I went to AA, and I thought, because I'm thinking again, if I'm in the program for 6 months, then I'd be in AA for 6 months, right? Makes sense to me. Okay, nobody told me that. It just kind of was understood. So I went to this place called AA. First of all, this girl that was in my group asked me, did I get a sponsor? Because they want you to get a sponsor, whatever that was at the time. They want you to get a sponsor. Then they explained it to me. So I went to the group, you know, and then this girl would always say to me, did you get a sponsor? You know, I couldn't stand her. Did you have a sponsor? So to shut her up, I told her one day, yeah, I got a sponsor, you know. But what happened, I went to this AA meeting, and this woman was up there. And she said, now, you know, you got to remember, I'm still with an active alcoholic. I ain't quite there myself. But I'm trying to tell him things that's happening in their groups and carrying on. And I'm listening to these stories. And I went to this meeting. This woman said that she had 5 years without drinking. After the meeting was over, I went to her. I said, you really have 5 years without drinking? You know what she said? And you can have it too, one day at a time. I couldn't get home fast enough. I went home. I said, let me tell you what I heard. This woman talking about she had 5 years of who that wanna drink, go without drinking for 5 years. Something's wrong with her. So what happened was that I ended up asking that lady to be my sponsor, and she's still my sponsor today. But what has happened to me, and I think I have about 3 minutes to tell you, if I can put sum up this wonderful program in 3 minutes, and I'm gonna tell you something, I love AA, so hang with me for a second. I came in here and learned a different language. I know today that my mother did not give me away, that another lady adopted me. There's a difference in the feeling, there's a difference in the seeing, and there's a difference in my heart with that. I came in here and heard the promises, and I remember asking my sponsor, are those true? She said, stay and see. The same son that I gave away 40-some years ago on my 18th anniversary came back into my life with a wife and 2 children and told me, don't worry about it. I love you. Everything is forgiven. The daughter that went through all that misery with me stand by my side today and tell me how much she loved me. I hope she always know how grateful I am that she's there and willing to stay there. She's here today. That granddaughter that I was babysitting for has never seen me drunk. Thank you, Father, for that. She can't imagine her grandmother being the one that goes in the street and falls down, and the one that her mother came around the corner one day and crossed the street because she didn't even want to speak to me because I was in such a drunken stupor that I was saying anything and everything out there in the street. I have come into this program, been supported by people. I've come in here a person that did not want to graduate from anything, didn't want to finish any kind of school, wasn't going to keep any kind of job. God got a sense of humor. The first job I had for 10 years was teaching people on the welfare how to get a job. Go figure. All right. I've been afforded the opportunity to go to school to receive a master's, to become a CRC, have an LMHC, and can get a job almost anywhere with God's help, because I don't believe in living in lack. Anything I want, my Heavenly Father got for me. I learned to count my blessings, and I've learned to hear how to be a friend, because I didn't know how, because I was a people pleaser and bought everything. Well, if it costs a dollar or two, you know what I mean. That kind of thing. But I've come in here and learned how to be loved, to accept love, and to give it. You will never know how I feel standing here with all of you still sitting out there wanting to understand and hear what I have to say, so all of us can stay sober another day, one day at a time. I just want to tell you, if you knew, stay here. Don't leave before the miracle. And let me say this. Ain't nowhere else to go. This is the best thing going right now. Alcoholics Anonymous, thank you for letting me share.
To introduce our next speaker, Ben. He's from the Perry Street Group, and I'm so excited to have him. Yay, Ben!
Thank you.
Yay, thank you.
Hi, I'm Ben. I'm an alcoholic. I lost my hair when I was 3 years old. I don't remember this, but my parents told me that they came into my bedroom and there were like chunks of hair on the pillow. And they didn't know what to do, so they took me around to a bunch of doctors and found out that it wasn't really anything serious. I was just going to lose all my hair as a little kid. The reason I share that with you is because it had an effect on the way that I grew up and the way I saw myself. I felt like I was different, and when I found alcohol when I was an adolescent, it seemed like the solution to a lot of my social anxiety, and alcohol was there through many of the profound experiences of growing up, getting a girlfriend, playing sports, making friends, and in high school there were bad side effects too, like blacking out, throwing up, accidents. But they didn't seem that serious. By the time I was 19, I was living in a dirty basement in a frat house in West Philly. And even the party animals that I was living with were telling me that I had a problem with alcohol. My best friend at the time bought me a t-shirt that said in big bold letters, Betty Ford Clinic. And I was really proud of that shirt. I felt like I'd earned it. And I would wear it around campus, usually with a hangover. And it was around that time that I saw flyers on the campus for an AA meeting. And it was around finals, and I figured it would be a good time to stop drinking. So I started going to those meetings. And I got sober for a couple months, and even though I went out, that was an important time for me because they gave me the Living Sober book, and I read it, and I kind of got this idea in my head that once I started drinking, I had no control whatsoever, and that was true. You know, sometimes I'd be fine, a lot of times I'd black out and do crazy things, but if I just didn't have that first drink, I could control it a little bit. And that had a profound effect on the next 6 years of my drinking. And I became a binge drinker. An example of that, during that time I lived in London, and one night I went out and I got blackout drunk, and I woke up the next day and my shins were swollen and they hurt. And I heard later that I'd run into a bench and fallen over it. And I remember in the morning I was feeling around in my mouth with my tongue and something felt wrong, and it turned out I was missing a big chunk of my front tooth, and I was really disappointed about that. But I found out that in London, being a problem drinker and having bad teeth doesn't exactly make you stand out. So another example from late, sort of the end of that time that I like to remember is July 4th weekend of 2004. I was living in San Francisco, and an old dear friend of mine came and picked me up in a beat up, white convertible, and he picked me up down on Market Street in San Francisco, and we were headed down to Santa Cruz for the weekend to, you know, maybe learn how to surf and party. And he had a case of Dos Equis in the car, and we were driving down the Pacific Coast Highway, cracking open beers. I like to remember that because it was a good start. At the end of that weekend, we were driving around Santa Cruz right around the time they stopped serving alcohol. And we stopped at a gas station, and we got in an argument over whose turn it was to buy the next 30-pack. And we missed the deadline to get beer, which was a big deal. And we wound up in a cheap motel room with a lot of people packed in and no beer. And I ended up getting in a fight with my friend, a physical fight. And people were screaming, and they called the management. Management said they were going to call the cops. And next thing I knew, my friend was popping the trunk of his beat-up white convertible and throwing my bag at me, and I was walking around San Francisco with no way, walking around Santa Cruz with no way to get back to San Francisco. At the end of that summer, I moved back to Philadelphia, and my life was unmanageable. I'd recently broken up with a girl I was living with, and I was living on an air mattress at a buddy's place, and starting to miss work. And I started going to AA, because I was desperate. And I got sober for about 3 months. And then I had my last big relapse. And the way it started, I got together with this ex-girlfriend who I hadn't seen in a while in a park in Philly for coffee. And it didn't go the way I wanted it to go. And it stirred up a lot of emotions in me, jealousy, fear, anger. And these were things that I didn't know how to deal with. The way I knew how to deal with those emotions was to drink. So I went to sleep that night, and I woke up the next morning. And I don't remember if I went to my AA meeting. I was in the habit then of going to this meeting at 7:15 in the morning. But I can tell you that if I went to that meeting, I wouldn't have raised my hand and shared about what was going on, because I didn't do that. I sat in the back, and I didn't feel comfortable sharing. I wouldn't have called my sponsor to talk about these feelings that I had no way to deal with, because I didn't have a sponsor. And I wouldn't have picked up my phone and called a buddy in the program, because even though there were some people I said hi to when I walked into the meeting, I didn't have anyone's number in my phone, and I didn't call anyone. I didn't intend to drink that day, but I'll tell you what I did do. I had a date that night, and we were going to a BYO place. So I felt like I had to go to a liquor store, and I had to get a bottle of Pinot Grigio. And I showed up at the restaurant, and she was there, and I didn't feel like I could tell her that I didn't drink, because I thought that would be strange. So when I was pouring her second glass of wine, she said, "Are you going to have a drink?" And I said, "Yeah." And I poured myself a glass, and I kept drinking for weeks, and then that turned into months. And, you know, I'd wake up during that time, and I knew I was an alcoholic. And I want to stop. I'd tell myself, I'm gonna stop today. And it just never happened. And it got to be December of 2004. It was about to become New Year's, and I had a plan. Two-part plan. Part one, I was going to go out on New Year's Eve, and I was going to party like a rock star, really hard. Part two of the plan was I was going to get up on New Year's Day of 2005, and I was going to go to that 7:15 a.m. AA meeting, and I was going to get sober, like a New Year's resolution. So I executed the first part of that plan flawlessly. Maybe too well, because I didn't even wake up. I didn't get home until about 3 in the afternoon on New Year's Day. I went to sleep, and by the time I woke up on my air mattress, I looked over at the little red flashing alarm clock, and it said 11:45 at night. And I thought, what happened? This was my day to get sober. Where did it go? But I thought, no problem. January 2nd, 2005, I'm getting sober. So I woke up late on January 2nd, and I didn't realize it, but there was football on TV that day. So I was in the habit at that time of going to a particular bar in Philly with my friends to sit around all day and watch the football games when they were on. So I went to that bar, and we were sitting around our table, and they all ordered beers. And I said, no thanks, I'm okay. And they said, what's going on? I said, it's cool, I quit drinking, I'm done. That worked really well for the early game. But then the late game came on, and I had a beer in my hand. When I think about being powerless over alcohol, that's the beer I think about. Because I didn't want to be drinking that beer. I knew where it took me by then. It wasn't fun anymore. But it just kept winding up in my hand. And I drank a bunch more, and tell you the truth, I don't know what happened. But the next day, on January 3rd, I got up, and I went to that 7:15 a.m. AA meeting, and I just kept going. And eventually, I started sharing, and I got a sponsor. I'd heard in the rooms that, you know, you should look for someone who has what you want. Ask them to sponsor you. So there was a guy that would come into the room, and he used to share about his mother, who was dead, and he would share that he would give anything he had, all his stuff, he would give it all up just to have another day with his mother. I had a strained relationship with my family, in particular my mother, when I came into the rooms. And my mother's here today. And she's with her husband, who's also my father. So I got a sponsor. That was good. And I kept going to that meeting. I just kept going, you know. I didn't always get there on time, but I would be there consistently. And time just went by. And it got to be, you know, 2.5 years later. And during that time, I graduated law school. And 2.5 years later, I got my dream job offer in New York City. And I thought real hard. I almost didn't come up here. And the reason that I almost didn't move to New York, check this out, was because I thought at the time that I wouldn't be able to, I was afraid that I wouldn't be able to find an AA meeting in New York City. So I shared that at my meeting in Philly, and somebody had that thick newspaper looking intergroup book, and they gave it to me, and I flipped through it, and I figured I'd be fine. Before I left for New York, there was an old guy in the rooms in Philly. He was kind of from the hood in Philly, and I'd gotten close with him. I'd done my fifth step with him, and he would give me advice sometimes if I shared at the meeting. Like, I would come in and I'd be jealous about a girlfriend. And he would take me aside after the meeting and say, Ben, jealousy is like standing on the beach and shoveling sand into the ocean with a bucket. I still don't know what that means, but it sounds nice. What he told me before I moved to New York, in his older age, he collected National Geographic magazines, and he brought one in right before I was moving to New York, and he gave it to me. It had a photo spread about gazelle on the African plain, and he pointed to it and he said, Ben, when you go up there to New York, You don't want to be one of these gazelle that's hanging out on the edge of the pack. Because that's the gazelle that gets eaten by the lion. He said, when you go up to New York, you get in the middle of the pack. And that's why I'm here. That's why I'm telling you my story right now. And when I came here, I went to lots of meetings, uptown, midtown, downtown. And it took me a while, but you know, I found some places where I felt comfortable. One of those places was Perry Street down in the Village, which is kind of a grimy, dirty little room with, you know, too many people packed in. But I heard a lot of honesty there, and I connected with people, and I was able to be honest myself. And I live in Hell's Kitchen, and there's a clubhouse on 46th Street where I like to hang out and go to meetings. And one of the great things for me about that clubhouse is they have a TV set in there. And so I can go there and I can watch sports games. And although I have to deal with the New York sports fans, I don't have to deal with being around alcohol, which is great. And, you know, I met my sponsor there. And I guess what I want to tell you about now is when I came into these rooms at 25 years old, I felt like my life was over in a way. Like I thought, you know, I'd go to work and kind of be a boring person. But I figured since I wasn't going to bars, I wasn't really going to have fun anymore. I wasn't going to make any new friends. And I seriously questioned whether or not I was going to get laid. And I'm happy to report that none of those concerns were valid. I'll tell you one of the fun things that happened to me in sobriety is I went down to climb a glacier with me, who doesn't climb. This was the team. It was me. It was my good friend in the program who was paralyzed from the neck down when he came in here. And it was my sponsor, who is a 67-year-old Puerto Rican, chain-smoking, self-repressed, blackout, falling down drunk. And that's not exactly the pedigree of the team of guys that you want climbing a glacier together. And we didn't get anywhere on this. It was a good example of, like, alcoholic planning, spur of the moment. But it didn't matter. We had a good time. I'd like to tell you one last story. About a year ago, one of my best friends from when I was drinking, my old drinking buddy, asked me to be his best man at his wedding. And I said yes. But as the bachelor party approached, I got very nervous because he wanted to have the bachelor party in New Orleans, Louisiana, and that was a place where I'd lived and drank a lot. And the plan was to go down there with him, who still drank, and 12 of my old drinking buddies who were still drinking, and kind of lead them around. And I was nervous about this, so I went to my meetings and I shared about it. And people came up to me after the meetings, and you know, somebody said, "Ben, why do you need to go down there to New Orleans with these guys?" I said, "Well, I'm the best man. I got it's part of my job description." He said, "No, you don't think they'll be all right without you?" And I thought about that. I argued with him, but then I thought about it, and I talked to people, and I figured that there were other things I could do to be a good best man: give the speech, call them up after the bachelor party and listen to their stories, which I did. And I didn't go, and I called them, and I heard their, you know, crazy stories about vans and strippers and people losing their wallets and people missing their flights, and it sounded like a mess. But that's not really what I wanted to tell you about. I want to tell you about what I did that weekend instead of going to New Orleans. My baby sister is here tonight, too, today, and she called me up, and she was home from college, and she like started running. like 3 or 4 miles was, I think, the most she'd done. And she had this crazy idea that she wanted to run this 10-mile race. And so I went home, and I ran this race with her. And we did it at her pace, and I was joking around with her the whole time and encouraging her. And we finished it together. And it's something that I'm never going to forget that. Not drinking between the ages of 25 and 30, I've missed a lot of bachelor parties. But having the opportunity to be the brother that I'm supposed to be the son that I'm supposed to be the person that I'm supposed to be, I wouldn't trade a drink for that. Thanks.
From the Rye Harrison Group. Woo! Anyway, our next speaker, I see her at a lot of places, and about 6 years ago when I was going through something, she saw me go through it with grace and dignity, and she really is a true power of example. I'm so pleased to introduce, from Westchester, Joyce from the Rye Harrison Group. Woo!
Hey, everybody. My name is Joyce. I am an alcoholic.
Hi, Joyce.
And I just want to say Ben and Beverly certainly are a hard act to follow. And also, it's late. You know, it's so much easier to go earlier. My sobriety date is December 1974. I don't say that so that you can all think that's so marvelous and I'm so marvelous, because that's far from the truth. But what it is it reminds me, and it also gives me the experience and the years here in this wonderful, fantastic program. I had a very, very difficult time getting sober. Very, very hard. It was, I can't believe, when as I stand up here, when I think about what my life was like as a kid, and when, excuse me, it was mentioned that Long Island was here, that's where I was born. I was born in Long Island, and I had a wonderful childhood. There was nothing anybody could have wanted more than I had. I was an only child, and I had parents who adored me, and I had anything and everything I could have wanted. And maybe that was one of the things, I don't know, but I don't even bother with that, you know? And I went away to a I went to a boarding school, at high school, and I went to college, and I married the man that I wanted to marry, and he wanted to marry me. And we started out in this life together, and it was absolutely terrific. It was terrific, and I liked what happened. He was in the Korean conflict, and he had gotten out of the Marines because of a physical situation, and he started in on the business world, and I suited it very well. I enjoyed all the people that I had to see, and I loved all the people that I met as I was going along. And I had two sons, not too close together, but they were rather close together, and I was into all the activities and the school activities, and alcohol just wasn't a problem with me. It wasn't even a condition. I didn't even drink until I was like 24 years old, of much of anything at all. And it seemed, as I said, so ironic that I would stand up here, and I was as sick an alcoholic as any one of you here in this audience. But when I was about a little over 30 years old, I had another boy, and we were very excited about all this. And the pediatrician came in, and he told me that my child was retarded. And it was as though somebody took a knife and just went right through my body. And the reason it did, and I didn't recognize it at the time, but I recognized it as the fact that I really had no spiritual condition. I lacked anything that would give me sustenance. I was out there free-floating. And I had never been free-floating in my life, so I didn't know what to do with it. 18 months later, I had my little girl, and she's here tonight. And it was wonderful. And everything was good for a little bit of time. But I was also always watching my weight, and I had always done that, but it became obsessive. And I had always picked up drinks, you know, we drank at night and had a drink or two at night before dinner, and we went to cocktail parties, and I was like that too. But after this, maybe after 2 or 3 years, I could see that alcohol was something that would help me. And that's how I looked at it. I looked at it as something that would not be a medicine necessarily, but it was something that got me through the busy hours. It got me moving. It gave me a little bit more zing because I wasn't so zing. Everything had sort of fallen down, all right? And the more I tried to pull it up, the more I wanted to drink. It went on like this for probably 2 or 3 or 4 years. No, maybe not even 4 years. I can't even remember. You know, when you've been around a while and nobody asks you to go out and speak necessarily, I take people out, you know? And it's been a long time since I'd actually told my story. but anyway, I had this child. And by the way, we did not bring this boy home. It was suggested he's still here with us today. And we have him in just a fabulous place up in upstate New York. And this boy just presented us with an art show that he was running and the head of it. And his things were more important than anybody else's. And I tell you, when I got that phone call, because his IQ is 29, and this is what these people have been able to do. And I never had any regret or any call of judgment when that was decided upon with his father. anyway, nobody was silent in my house about the extra drinks I was drinking. I hadn't yet gotten to the morning drink, but that came very quickly as well. I would take the kids to school, and I'd come home, and I had some help because they decided help was good for me, too. That would help, and also I could go out and do more things, and maybe that would be help. And everybody tried. I just want you all to know that I never blamed, I did in the beginning, but I didn't blame anyone for my alcoholism. I knew that I had done this, and I knew that I was sick. And to see a psychiatrist in 1970 or 71 was just not heard of, you know, and I was hiding. I was hiding under the alcohol, and finally it was decided that I should go away, and they sent me to the Institute of Living in Hartford, Connecticut. And I don't know if anybody's ever been there. But it's not a nice place. It's not a nice place. And yet I managed to get in and, you know, involved in whatever it was, but I paid no attention to my drinking. I really paid no attention. And it was necessary to run away from there because I just about had enough. I couldn't talk to my children. You know, my husband didn't want me speaking to them. He didn't want me upsetting them and that kind of thing. So I decided I was going to run away. And I hitchhiked home with a man who was drinking beer. And he brought me from Hartford to the George Washington Bridge. I was living in New Jersey. And I get home. And I wasn't in the house 10 minutes. And I was in a car going to buy more alcohol. And that's how it went. And my poor daughter, you know, was caught in the middle of so much of this stuff. And I'm not going to go into any, really, there's no more detail to go in. You've all picked up alcohol. You all know the rules. You know that it gets to the point where nothing in my sphere was important to me anymore. The only thing that was important for that last year was that I picked up a drink of alcohol every day, and I was able to keep a high all day. And that was the way it went. And at night, I remember saying to my husband, I said, I'd wake up in the night and I'd say, I'm so scared. And he'd look at me and he'd say, you're waking me up. And you've never been afraid of anything in your life. What in the world is wrong with you? And that was what it was, you know. And I was very, very sick. And finally, in 1972, I went to New York Hospital, and I was not allowed to go home. I was not allowed to go home. And I'd have to find some other means because I was ruining the household, and everybody couldn't put up with the, with my goings on. So I left there, and with the help of the people there and others, people that I knew, I was able to find a place, and I got a job. And I hadn't had a job in a very, very long time, back before I had actually gotten married. I worked for a short time. And I got a job with Rheingold Brewery. And you talk about, it was so good for me. It was, I didn't drink the alcohol, but it was so good because the job was just about up to what I could handle. You know, I was so screwed up. And I went to Alcoholics Anonymous, I did. And I didn't listen to the people who took me on there, under their wing, or tried to. And you can't take somebody under their wing if they're not going to be taken. So I somehow stayed without alcohol, and finally 2 years later, almost 2 years later, shy a bit, I picked up a drink for a day and a half, and I had gotten custody, of my daughter, and her dad came in, and he took her, and he said to me, Joyce, when are you ever going to get self-honest? It would have been better if you had just jumped in that river, and you would have caused us a lot less havoc. And so I took a shower after I woke up and I was okay. And I first thing I did was go get my hair done. That's the first thing on the agenda for any woman who's 40 years old. You might as well just go and do that and get it over with. And so I went to the meeting, and it was Christmas was coming upon us. And when it came my turn, I told these people that I had picked up a drink, and I was very drunk for a day and a half or so, 2 days. And they said they weren't a bit surprised. Not one bit surprised. They said, you know, you have not done anything that we've asked you to do, and this program is only going to work for those of us who work the program. And they told me to go home and get down on my knees and ask for help, just not to drink today. Just not to drink today, and to get on my knees at night and say thank you for just not drinking. Forget the husband, forget the money, forget the this, that. Just concentrate on that. And I did this, and time began to pass. And I joined the Roy Harrison group, and these women, there were two women in particular, and one of them became my first sponsor, and then she got sick, and then the second one took over. And these people gave of their time and their life to me. And they gave me such wonderful advice. And I also, at that time, I also spent a lot of time in Mamaroneck. Mamaroneck had just started. It was later on, actually, that they were reading out of the big book. And we didn't have that yet, and it was brand new. And I didn't understand these steps. And if there's anybody here who is having problems, and they you know, they have to admit it, that they just don't quite get it. And that was the way it was with me. I just didn't get it. And it wasn't all of it. It was just the bits and parts that I just didn't understand. And it was necessary for me to open my mouth, which I can do very well about other things, but it was necessary for me to open my mouth and be honest with the fact that I absolutely would like to have a better discussion on this. And I went to anything and everything. They said that God had given me the time. They had given me the time, and I was with my daughter and my sons as much as I could be. We had another little issue that came up regarding the children, and I had to acquiesce to that, and I had to recognize that it's not all about you, Mom. It's about us. And they didn't say that. That was not a cliche at that time, but that is exactly what it was. You know, I had to be content, and it was very difficult for me to be content, because I am an action person, and that has began to work for my benefit. And it began to work because I was able to just come and go exactly as I pleased. And I spent a lot of time at Sponsor House, which is in White Plains. And I love AA. I just love everything about it. I love all of you. There isn't anybody in these rooms that wouldn't do for us what we need. Nobody. And if they are, they don't belong here. They've made a mistake. It's been a very, very wonderful life. When I was sober, I don't know, Andy, how long was it? Maybe a year and a half or two. This man came out of a Porchester meeting one Friday night, and I had said whatever thing I said, and he said to me, "Do you think you're the only one who ever lost their children?" And I looked at him, and I said, "Well, I beg to differ." And he said, would you like to go and have coffee? And we did, and I didn't see much of him for a while, but he showed up every once in a while, and he was just wonderful. He had 9 years when I first came, got sober this time. We dated for about, I don't know, 3 or 4 years, and we got married. And we've been married 30 years, and it's been terrific. Now, I have to let you people go, but coming in here today, we had a bit of a thing on we ended up on the Cross Bronx, and I was beside myself because Sean told me I had to be here at 11:30 or 12, and I showed every character defect I have, and we had two friends in the car. So I have to go home and make some amends and hope that they will have been in good graces here to accept them. I cannot tell you anything else without going over time. But last Sunday, I was at grandchildren's graduation, and he spoke for the graduation, my grandson did. And he closed, and I'd like to do the same. And it may not be totally AA, but I think it's the Irish prayer. May the road rise up to meet you. May the winds be always at your back. May the sun shine warm upon your face. And the rains fall softly in your fields. And until we meet again, good friends, may God hold you in the palm of his hand. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Amazing.